Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is May 5th, 2022. This is the third case on our calendar this morning for oral argument. I'm Louise Bjorkman. I am joined this morning on the panel by Chief Judge Siegel and Judge Hooten. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. I understand that a different counsel will be presenting the rebuttal argument on behalf of the appellant. It's important that you state your name and identify the parties you represent when you begin your argument. And I would also remind everyone on the line that no recording is permitted of this Zoom hearing. With that, counsel for appellant, Mr. Saylor, you may proceed.
Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Tori Saylor. I represent the state of Minnesota in this appeal. And Mr. Hackworthy, as noted earlier, will be taking the rebuttal going forward from here. Victims of domestic assault have a voice. Their statements, experiences, injuries are the bedrock of what gives this voice purpose. This case focuses on a victim of repeated domestic assaults. And like many, the victim here, AH, is no longer able to use her voice to tell her story. By either choice or compulsion, AH is no longer cooperating with the judicial process, and the only way for her story to be told has been denied by the district court. The district court's order is flawed in application of law, findings of fact, and conclusions of law. The state wins this.
Can I ask you, I mean, aren't we bound by the findings of fact unless they're clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be a clearly erroneous standard for findings of fact. However, here there was absolutely no in-court testimony that was taken, and everything that this court can review is available via the record. The district court didn't really conclude or find certain things that were raised and certain statements that were made and viewed on the actual record. The district court reasoned various ways to arrive at what was possibly argued a pre-conclusion or a pre-decided fact, and negated certain statements that AH had made that was available for review on the body-worn camera.
Just to confirm then, we're looking at the issue, the confrontation clause issue de novo, and the evidentiary decision that these statements would be excluded under the hearsay rules for abuse of discretion, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, and one more sort of preliminary question before we get going. To the extent the district court ruled that the state would be permitted to offer portions of AH's statements made to the paramedics, is the critical impact requirement met? And if so, why?
It is, Your Honor. And as agreed upon by both the appellant and respondent, the issue becomes identity here. As we know, statements made in purpose of medical treatment cannot identify who caused the injury or who caused the issue that is seeking the medical treatment, with the exception of maybe criminal sexual conduct cases. Here, that doesn't apply, and therefore there would be an issue of identifying who the actual alleged assailant is. So as we've already kind of dived into the two different issues and the different reviews that are required here, the hearsay exception is a review based on clear abuse of discretion. The district court did fail to make certain conclusions and actually went beyond what the record showed in finding that the defendant in this case, Mr. Tapper, was sleeping in an apartment. That was one of the big issues that the district court had raised in its order. The district court said that there was no ongoing emergency and that, you know, Ms. Holmes was basically remarkably calm. But there were certain statements that were clear on this body-worn camera that would indicate otherwise. Specifically, Ms. Holmes was a recent victim of an assault. She was describing pain. She was describing her head injury, her broken nose. She was wiping what appeared to be blood from underneath her nose. This is clearly visible on the body-worn camera. And statements that Ms. Holmes made to Officer Johnson at that time related directly to the fear of her life coming up to the weekend is completely devoid in the district court's order.
Well, but I think what the district court did is said, look at the context in which that statement was made. I mean, as I listened to the body and, you know, viewed the body camera several times, I mean, there's statements about, you know, the first statement is, I'm not leaving my kids. And then she immediately goes on to retell what has happened. And the statement, as I think what the district court, how the district court took the statement about, I thought I was going to die this weekend if I did not report, is a statement about how she was feeling at the time of the assault. Why am I wrong about that?
Well, Your Honor, because when she's saying these things, not only is she describing the pain and how she sustained those injuries, but she's also at the same time stating things such as, oh my God, my kids are in there. And the notable difference in her voice at that time would suggest that she was not having an opportunity to reflect on this statement. She was not having an opportunity to fabricate different issues than what actually took place. And that's an important thing for this court to remember, and also for the district court to remember, that the entire purpose of admitting evidence into a trial is that that evidence has a surety of truthfulness. And the entire bedrock of the excited utterance statement is that those statements are being given underneath the stress where a person cannot go back and fabricate instances of what took place. And when you get to that point, Your Honor, yes, she may have been saying, I am fearful of my life if I didn't report, but it goes into context and it goes into the totality of the circumstance. AH was out in a hallway pounding on doors. That caused a neighbor to call 911, and he was fearful that she was being assaulted or just recently assaulted. And these injuries, they're fresh. These were things that happened mere moments beforehand. And I think that that goes to another point that the district court failed to observe and failed to recognize, was that these statements didn't come some 90 minutes or an hour or a day or a week later. These came mere moments after an assault took place, as evidenced by her holding her nose and wiping blood from her face.
So if I could switch your attention a bit to the Confrontation Clause issue. So even if we were to accept at least a portion of the body cam video, you know, was an excited utterance. But how do we get around it being testimonial?
And Your Honor, this goes into a de novo review. This is going to be a review that you can see from all the evidence that's before you. And the issues that are present here that distinguish the cases that the district court relied upon are very apparent and very clear. Mr. Tapper was not in custody. Mr. Tapper's whereabouts were speculative at best. Police believed that Mr. Tapper was in an apartment complex, but the door was locked and there was no response to officers knocking on that door asking for him to answer.
Is there any evidence, though, based on the statements AH made, that he had left? I mean, doesn't she in fact say there's nowhere he would have gone? I'm sure he's there. He's probably asleep.
That is true. But again, that does not necessarily matter, because this is a subjective review of how the officers were responding to this event. This is not a review of, okay, Mr. Tapper had not left the apartment. At the time that Officer Johnson arrived and these statements were being given, the review is supposed to be, how did those officers approach the situation? And here is the problem that the district court never arrived at, was that the officers knew at least two, if not three, children were in an apartment where a suspect of a domestic assault was locked behind a door. The questions that the officers were asking were not related to proving or disproving a domestic assault had just taken place. The questions the officers were asking were related to trying to determine what type of situation they were dealing with, whom they were dealing with.
What indication did AH make in her statements? Understanding, as we have all watched the body cam, and understanding her almost very first statement is, I'm not leaving my kids. What else about the statements she made or the questions that the officers asked her would suggest that concern about the children being in the apartment with Mr. Tapper was the primary purpose of the questioning?
I think that goes into her narrative format of how these injuries had taken place and how police actually got called. Her voice changed considerably when she spoke about, oh my God, my kids are in there. or something to that extent. And when she's talking to officers about that, and remember that these officers are replying to a neighbor who called thinking that there was a domestic assault that just took place, the officers have to be thinking and determining whether or not they have potential victims there. Whether or not AH is actually saying that they're going to be a victim or not really is irrelevant. Officers need to be looking at this as, this person is a suspect of a violent crime. He has two young children in there. We need to respond in an appropriate manner. Which I think goes to the lack of direct questioning that Officer Johnson posed to AH. The questions that Officer Johnson was posing to AH were not asking, how many times did he hit you? Where did he hit you? They were asking questions like, is he underneath the influence of meth? Is he drunk? Is there anything else in that room that we need to know about? How did you get these injuries? Where does it hurt? Should I get you medical attention? This was not questioning that was investigative in nature, and AH's statements were not reflecting on looking at pursuing or prosecuting Mr. Tapper. She was trying to get medical help. She was asking for an ambulance to come out and check her out because she thought her nose was broken and that she might have some type of a cranial injury. So going back to the question of whether or not Ms. or AH's statements were testimonial or not, the court should be reviewing whether or not these statements were given in the formality of an interrogation, which they were not. As Your Honor just pointed out, Ms. Holmes proffered this information virtually uninhibited. She was not questioned for the most part. She just started in a narrative format of what took place.
Again, statements about what had happened in the past. And that's my biggest, that seemed to be that was important to the district court and obviously important to us. If the primary purpose of her statements and the questions was to determine what had happened, rather than dealing with an ongoing emergency, that's the critical piece. What is it about her statements that relate to an ongoing emergency?
Well, her statements weren't necessarily relating to the past. They were explaining to Officer Johnson about why she needed to have medical attention as well. She kept saying that, I think my nose is broken because I was punched. I think that my head is hurt because I was kicked or thrown. These are not statements saying that, I want him to be prosecuted. These are statements that she's saying, hey, I need to get help here. I need to be checked out. I might have a concussion. I'm not for sure. And these are exactly the same statements that were coming up with a police officer in Warsame, which is why the state suggested the district court look at Warsame in a little bit of a more favorable light than it did, because Warsame is actually very similar, in fact, to what this case relates to. In that case, as you know, the declarant wasn't actually with the suspect. In fact, she was several yards, if not blocks, away from where this had taken place, and with a police officer on the side of a road. Just like this case, yes, Ms. AH was a few yards, maybe a few feet away from Mr. Tapper, but she was explaining to Officer Johnson why she needed the ambulance to come. And if you look at the statements as a totality of what's going on here, her statements to the paramedics are almost identical to the statements that she gave to Officer Johnson. So in a sense, if the court is going to allow those statements to come in as an exception to the hearsay rule underneath the medical treatment exception, it fails logic to then deny them as an exception to the hearsay rule. Because again, if we're trying to maintain this sense of trustworthiness of a statement by a declarant that's not available for testimony, it makes no sense that the court would find a medical exception rule would give some type of proffer of trustworthiness of the statement versus a excited utterance where the ultimate determination is the same, yet we're denying it because it doesn't exhibit some hallmark of stress, which is where I want to move.
It seems to me, Mr. Saylor, I'm looking at, again, back to the Warsame case, and there are certainly similarities and differences. A difference would be that, the victim in that case was fainting and there was, the officer independently decided, I need an ambulance for emergency care, as opposed to the officer's assessment here that we'll let somebody check out AH. It's a difference in terms of the level of medical care required or the urgency of the medical concerns. Would you agree with that?
Your Honor, officers are not permitted to determine if somebody has a brain injury. And here, AH was saying she had something wrong or she thought she had a concussion with her head. That should indicate that not only was there a serious assault that took place, but there was also some type of a medical evaluation that needs to be done that goes beyond what an officer's ability would be. So Officer Johnson's questioning and answering was related to that. And I just want to point one more thing out here. AH has been the victim of several, alleged victim of several domestic abuses. Her ability or lack thereof to be able to articulate in an excited manner what Bauer and Beresford would suggest is not controlling here. She was in shock. She was just assaulted by a person that she shared her life with and she loves and she has a child with. And in concluding, I ask that this court reverse the district court because of the errors that were outlined here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent, Ms. Quiggle.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Jasmine Quiggle, and I represent the respondent in this case, Mr. Tapper. Your Honors, the district court correctly found that the statements made by Ms. Holmes during the first 8 minutes and 17 seconds of the body camera video are inadmissible because they do not fall within the excited utterance exception, and admission would violate respondents' rights under the Confrontation Clause. As Your Honors have focused mainly on the Confrontation Clause issue, that's where I would like to begin. The key issue here is whether, as Ms. Holmes made these statements, there was an ongoing emergency. But that's not where the analysis stops. The question is also, and that was held by the Supreme Court in Michigan v. Bryant, whether the questions asked and the answers given were made to meet such an ongoing emergency.
Well, the very first statement out of AH's mouth was, "I'm not leaving my kids." Doesn't that indicate that that was her focus, that in fact she had ongoing concern about her children? That and the primary purpose for her then going on to answer questions and describe the situation really was about her children.
Your Honor, I believe that is one way to look at it, but I believe another one is that she did not want to leave, that she, as Mr. Saylor has pointed out, there have been domestic violence incidents at that address in the past potentially. And Ms. Holmes later also mentioned that she did not just want to go stay with your sister. And I viewed her statement as that she did not want to just leave the residence for a cool down. Her immediate statement following the statement about the children is that she does not have her shoes. So there are definitely certain concerns on Ms. Holmes' mind relating
to
that. Well,
the very first statement, "I'm not leaving my kids," she immediately followed with, "He punched me in the face. He threw hand sanitizer all over me. He threw me into the fireplace." I mean, why don't the linkage of those, and this is before any question is really asked other than which unit are we going to, why doesn't that set the tone of the ongoing emergent concern about the children?
Because all of those statements are relating to her. He threw hand sanitizer in my face. There's no indication, and she never makes a statement, that there has been a threat to the children or that he has, in the course of this incident, hurt the children. And her emergency, if there ever was one, is over because she is in the presence of the officers. The officers have her removed from the situation. She is in the hallway where she's answering questions surrounded by multiple officers. I think Mr. Saylor made a point that this situation should be evaluated from the subjective view of the officers and how the officers responded to the situation. And I believe that is very telling here, considering that Officer Johnson, although Ms. Holmes' very first statement was, "I'm not leaving my children," Officer Johnson did not ask about the children. She did not ask how many children are in the apartment. She did not ask how old they are. She did not ask, "Are they in danger? Are they injured?" Officer Holmes starts her question. She asks whether Ms. Holmes needs medical attention. But then it is very clear that that is not emergent because it is just to have Ms. Holmes checked out. Officer Johnson does not ask how they could get into the apartment quickly if the children are in danger. She does not ask anything like that. So Officer Johnson's questions really are not made to meet an ongoing emergency, even if there was one. rather she just asked what has happened in the past. And as Your Honor correctly stated earlier, that is the big difference here. The court has held in cases where during 911 calls, victims were describing what is happening. He's fleeing. That is not.
But the fact, I mean, you know, the officers show up. They don't know anything except they've been notified by a dispatcher. There's a domestic going on. And insofar as there are initial questions being asked and information is volunteered, in order for those officers to decide, is this an emergency or is it not? What are we dealing with? Isn't it possible, at least under Warsami, that those initial questions are if there's evidence of an ongoing emergency, that those initial questions are non-testimonial, and that even in the same conversation, that they can become testimonial once the determination is made as to whether there's an ongoing emergency or not. Am I correct with my understanding of the law?
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor, that the nature of the questioning can make a non-testimonial statement testimonial during the course of the interrogation. But I believe that the facts in Warsami were significantly different. And we're in Warsami.
In this case, though, the officers, I mean, you know, there may have not been an ongoing emergency as to her because she's got two officers around her. But there is an ongoing emergency, is there not, or possible emergency with regard to the location of the defendant?
Your Honor, I would respond.
And whether the children may or may not be a victim of his outburst.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that because I don't think that there is any indication that the respondent had left the apartment at that point. As Ms. Holmes even stated said later in her statement, there's no way he has left. He has probably just fallen asleep. I believe that at that point, considering the relatively quick response time from the officers between the 911 call and the encountering Ms. Holmes in the hallway, there is no indication that respondent had left or that the children were in danger because the call came in for Ms. Holmes and not for the children. And Ms. Holmes did not make any statements regarding the children.
The primary purpose of the interrogation in order to make this determination, and if the officers are asking these questions with regard to determining whether there is an ongoing emergency, wouldn't they be admissible as non-testimonial?
Your Honor is absolutely correct that we need to look at the primary purpose of the interrogation, and I think. For looking at that, we need to look at Officer Johnson's behavior, knowing that one of the first things Officer Johnson does is she takes out her notepad, she has Ms. Holmes spell her name, she has her take down the phone number, which indicates some formality in taking the statements. It is not a frantic questioning of, oh my God, where are the children? What can we do to help? Officer Johnson is taking the initial steps to prepare her report by getting all the necessary information that will need to be in there. And that is a very good indication of how, again, subjectively the officers are looking at it. Now,
what is there a difference between the what I will call the volunteered statements, the statements that AH made before there was questioning about her medical condition or what had happened, that those statements, I'm not leaving my kids, and then the initial, this is what happened, what he did to me, that would be non-testimonial, and perhaps the rest of the statements would be testimonial. Is there a reason that we shouldn't distinguish between those initial voluntary statements and the response to questions?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe there is, and that is because they relate to events that happened in the past. They do not relate to the ongoing emergency as it is happening now. And Ms. Holmes is not describing my kids are in danger now, or my, or I am worried for my safety now. Rather, she is looking back as to what happened to her. And yes, it spills out of her. It spills out of her. She lets the officer know. But I also think it's important to look at all of the circumstances, and that you can clearly see that later on in the video, Ms. Holmes shows some regret about in the past not having cooperated fully with investigations and asking to have a Danko dropped. And I believe those initial statements are more of a show of regret towards that, and a show for her to ensure that she is cooperating with the officers now. She is telling them the whole story now so that in the future, Mr. Tapper can be prosecuted. And that again looks at the purpose of the statements that she has made. It is not made to meet an ongoing emergency. Rather, the statements are made so that prosecution can be facilitated in the future.
What case can you point us to that you think is most like your situation or your client's situation here? In discussing, you know, whether this is testimony or non-testimony.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the case most similar to our situation here comes from Davis v. Washington, and is the Hammond situation in that case, where also the officer responded to a domestic. The officers were with the victim. I believe that the situation there was even a little bit more chaotic than it was in ours, because in Hammond, the alleged assailant was just in the next room over, and he was still trying to interject himself into the conversation while the police were asking questions. I think that is very similar to what it is here. It also bears the same formality indications as our case here, where the officer sat down with the alleged victim, took down some information, took down the name, and then had her recount what had happened in the past, rather than what is happening now, as they did in Warsami. And in that, I believe that that case is specifically different because the officers had no information. They knew that in Warsami, the defendant was still on the loose. They had information that there was a potential second victim that was injured. They had a reasonable belief that the defendant was armed, and the victim in Warsami was showed severe injuries. There was a baseball side lump on her forehead. She was wobbly. The officer was afraid she would faint. The officer had her sit down and asked her those questions, not with a notepad in hand, taking down her information, but instead while giving her first aid.
So, Ms. Quiggle, how do you respond to Mr. Saylor's argument that this case, in fact, is like Warsami, to the extent that when the officers arrived and when the challenged statements are made, they don't know where Mr. Tapper is, and they have there is some indication that there's a 10, 6, and 4-year-old children with him if he's still in the apartment. So potential other victims. Why isn't this like Warsami?
I believe it is not like in Warsami, because in Warsami, the officers knew that the assailant had fled. They knew for sure that he was gone. They believed him to be armed, and there was a victim in the case here. They didn't, in fact, know how many children there were in the apartment or if the children had been injured at all. That all came out only much, much, much later in the investigation. So then, Your Honors, I would like to briefly address the excited utterance issue as well, and would stress that the district court made factual findings that support its conclusion that those statements were excited utterances, that Ms. Holmes appeared remarkably calm, did not appear frightened, did not mention fear when she said that her children were in the apartment, that she appeared downcast and sad, and that she answered questions in a straightforward manner. The standard of review here is clearly erroneous. So this court only disturbs those factual findings if there is no reasonable support for those findings in the record. I understand that appellant disagrees with the court findings, but reasonable minds can disagree. and only because appellant disagrees does not mean that there is no support in the record. In fact, after all, we've all watched a body camera video, and Ms. Holmes certainly does not display the indications of excited utterances as in cases like Ferris Ford, where the defendant was shaky, very upset.
To some extent, that's in the eye of the beholder, right? And which is why we defer to the district court's discretion in making that sort of an evaluation. But I mean, I have to say, to my view, A.H. is upset. She's sniffling. She's wiping her nose with, it's dark, so I assume it's blood that she's wiping away. It seems like there are plenty of indicia of being under the aura of what has just happened to her at the time she's talking to the police officers.
Your Honor, she's certainly not happy. I would argue that she is not under the stress required to meet the excited utterance threshold. All of the cases are mentioning like extremely agitated, very afraid. She's not, but she is only slightly frightened. And Your Honor, I see my time is up, so unless there are any questions.
I mean, she does state, though, that she thought she was going to die that weekend. I mean, isn't that indicative of a level of fright?
She does, Your Honor, but she also follows that up by, if I don't report. So I think the fear would have been for the future rather than the present.
Thank you, Ms. Quiggle. Now we will hear from Mr. Hackworthy for 5 minutes rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is David Hackworthy, and as a prior clerk of the court, it's a pleasure to be back before you, not appearing in Tort Center, as I think my last appearance was. I want to hit on first the excited utterance that the respondent just mentioned. And I think the key fact there that the state focuses on, I think has been mentioned a few times, is the district court relied on what it assumed was a fact that the defendant was sleeping at the time that the questioning was going on. The inquiry that this court should be looking to, which is stated in Lastnet, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case, is what the officers perceived at the time, not in hindsight. And I think that's where the court here made an abuse of discretion. It not only used an erroneous legal standard, which is looking at everything in hindsight rather than from the standard of what the officers knew at the time, but it also simply found a fact that I think was convenient and made its conclusion easier to support. Here, A.H. does not state he was sleeping. She states that he was maybe passed out due to alcohol use, which I think would only further the concern that you mentioned, Judge Bjorkman, for the children here. While the defendant's location may have been known in that he could have been in the apartment, the key inquiry here isn't whether officers for sure knew where he was or had a reasonable basis to assume where he was. It's whether or not he was in custody. And I think that goes back to the Crawford issue here of whether or not there's an ongoing emergency.
I'm struggling with what the ongoing emergency is when most of A.H.'s statements clearly are descriptive of what has happened to her in the past. She's no longer faced with her assailant. She's safe in the hallway with the police officer. What's the emergency at that point?
Well, so from the officer's perspective, and again, you know, I know that there is much to do, that there is only Officer Johnson. There are other officers off scene, again, trying to frantically get into the apartment. And again, the key, I think, inquiry for this court under Lastnet is what the officers looked at. But I think if you're looking at it from A.H.'s perspective, she's clearly concerned about her kids. She's not concerned about her kids being in an apartment with a guy who's sleeping, as the district court would found and as the respondent here would have this court support. Rather, she is concerned for her children with an individual that she has a history of abuse with, an individual who is maybe under the influence of alcohol, and that's why he may or may not be passed out, and an individual who she informs Officer Johnson can only be calmed down by the older child who isn't present at that time. And so I think
what statements does A.H. make, or what indication does she give in her statements that would have caused Officer Johnson to think that the three children were at risk in that apartment?
I think one of the opening statements she makes is, oh my God, my children are in there. And I know the respondent's brief is, you know, why didn't they immediately bust down the door at that time? And I think, again, not only is that an unreasonable indication of how police react in these situations, especially when they have an unknown assailant who could be armed behind a locked door. But again, Officer Johnson didn't immediately go running to the apartment like, oh my God, there's kids in there, because she knew that there were officers there addressing the situation contemporaneously while she was with AH. And again, I think the key fact here, which goes back to Warsame, is that the defendant was not in custody. The inquiry isn't, is a defendant off running? Did the police, are they in, you know, hot pursuit of him, or are they looking for him? It's whether or not the defendant is in custody. And I think that's a key indicator of when a ongoing emergency ends, because at that point in time, AH would know that she is, you know, comfortable, she's safe, the defendant is no longer a risk to her or the kids. And that's why the state here asked to put in these statements for the first, I think, 7 or 8 minutes, because later on, the defendant is in custody. In fact, when AH is in the back of the ambulance for the statements that the district court did allow in under the medical examiner's exception, the defendant is in custody. And even there, the district court found enough indicia of trustworthiness to the individuals in the ambulance to allow those statements in. And so I think if you undercut the district court's finding of fact that the defendant was sleeping, the rest of the argument kind of falls away there, both for the excited utterance hearsay exception and for whether or not an ongoing emergency was going on. And again, there's simply no facts in the record. It was a clearly erroneous finding. And that's why, you know, this court should reverse and remand to the district court for proper findings in that regard. Thank you.
Can I ask you, how is this case distinguishable from Hammond? I mean, isn't it the same thing that the police know that she's okay because they've got two police officers there and they know he's not going to hurt her again. And they also know he's in the apartment with his kids, his younger kids. And the finding here is that she does not say anything about that the kids are, that he's going to harm the kids. So we have an officer almost from the first beginning knocking on the door, trying to get him to open the door. So he knows he's in there. I assume that's why he was knocking on the door. I mean, how is this different than Hammond, where you actually have, you know, they know where the assailant is?
So I think there's two differences. First, in Hammond, the defendant, the alleged assailant, is in custody. I mean, yes, he's in another room next door, but police have the victim, in their own, I guess, kind of custody, protecting her. And the defendant is next door. There's no ongoing concern for the victim there. Here, the ongoing emergency goes not only to AH's safety and protection, it goes to these children. And I think that is a key factual distinction between Davis and Hammond, where you have victims who are not, you know, present with police there to protect them. You have a victim who is saying, you know, oh my God, my children are in there. And looking at the body cam, she has clear tonal inflections, not of, oh my God, my children are in there, but as a concerned mother. And I think that's, again, a key fact that the district court either just
concerned about not being separated from her children. But I mean, unlike Warsame, where there was reason to believe that there is another potential victim. I mean, is there any evidence here, or any indication made to these officers in the first 8 minutes that they spoke with AH that Tapper had ever assaulted or hurt or threatened to hurt any of these children?
Well, I think there are AH's statement that, you know, the older child isn't there and he's the only one that can, quote, calm him down. There's a history of abuse here that usually arises from the defendant being under the influence of alcohol, and AH again states, you know, he's probably passed out because of, you know, he's intoxicated or drunk. And so, you know, beyond that, I mean, in Warsame, yes, you know, we had someone who was a victim that was stabbed. And I mean, maybe that's a bit more obvious to the court, but I think that just because here you don't have that same obviousness to the officers only further arises the concern. They don't know what state the children are in. And again, going back to last night, that's the key perspective that I think the district court erred in and that this court should focus on. It's what the officers knew at the time. They knew that there were children in there with an individual with a history of abuse. When he's under the influence, you have a concerned mother for being separated, whether she's concerned for being separated because she's not physically there to comfort them or because she's concerned that she can't protect them. We don't know, but either one could be true. And the officers don't see the children. They don't see what state they're in. And so that's why the state is arguing that the ongoing emergency was going on until at least, you know, officers could walk in, confirm that the children were okay, confirm what Mr. Tapper's state was in, and then take him into custody. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case was well presented. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.
Thank you.